understand his feelings about that. I would love to do that tonight myself. But I won't do it. I simply have enjoyed immensely and thoroughly the opportunity to speak to many of you here in the assemblies after the service is over, before it begins. It's something I look forward to very, very eagerly and have enjoyed it immensely, and look forward to speaking to you again before the week is out. I especially want to see David Williams' baby. I just hope I can get some opportunity to experience that. There are a couple of things that I miss more than anything else in New York, I guess, the work we're doing up there. One of them is the children and the young people. I just love these here so much, and it's such a wonderful experience to have them, even the babies that cry occasionally. I get hungry for that. We don't have any babies or young children at all in the church, and I miss them. And another thing I miss are the deacons. I just tell you the truth. You who know me know I don't think about details, and if somebody doesn't hand me a microphone when I get up to speak, where's the microphone? But if they hand it, but I have to carry all of that to the place of meeting and carry it away, and I just really miss all of the assistants and help, not only the deacons, but the deacons' wives and a lot of other servants who may not have been appointed deacons, but so many who have helped so much. But I know you are with me, with Kanita, in our work there. You tell us of that in so many ways, through emails and letters and words through our children and prayers that you tell us you're offering, and we just are so grateful for that. I just can't tell you what it means to us in strengthening us for the work that we're endeavoring to do. We're so glad that Brother Don and Cammie Bunting, who've been here both days, I believe, are coming up to work with us. It'll be a relief to us to have them on the ground. We plan to stay up there, but it will certainly be a blessing to have them there even when we're away. And if something should occur to require us to come back, they would be there to continue the work. And we are just grateful for their willingness to come. There are a lot of other things I would like to say. I do want to say that I'm so glad my wife could come. My sisters were here a couple of days and last night, and it's just been an enjoyable occasion. But we're not here primarily to enjoy ourselves. We're here primarily to worship and serve the Lord. And I know that's what you're here for tonight, and I'm glad you're here. I want to urge you to be back tomorrow night. My wife and I went over the list and realized there were a number of good people we hadn't seen yet this week. And tomorrow night, Earnhardt will be speaking again, and you know from experience that you can look forward to something very edifying and beneficial. And I hope you'll be back with any others that you may be able to bring with you. A number of years ago, as many of you recall, there was an increasing curiosity and interest in the space travel and in the possibility of life in outer space. I don't know what all contributed to it. Perhaps it was the space program itself, but interest was piqued in the possibility of others coming into this world from other planets or from other stars. And occasionally there were reports of flying saucers, lights that couldn't be explained. And my grandmother even thought she saw a flying saucer. I don't know who put her up to that. I don't know that she would have even known what it was if somebody hadn't been talking to her, but I think that was a lot of it. It was just the consciousness of the possibility of this kind of thing that made anything you couldn't quite explain be a possible flying saucer. And there were even reports of creatures that came down here and appeared in our atmosphere and on our world. And sometimes they would even kidnap people and take them up in a spaceship and bring them back. And the cartoons were all contributing to this, and the tabloid papers, and there was just almost a hysteria about it. It was assumed that if an alien came, that he would have supernatural powers, that he would be some strange-looking creature, and I, for some reason, it was supposed he would be hostile, and that we somehow or other would have to defend ourselves against this supernatural, unexplained kind of a being. Well, of course, none of that ever happened. That There never was an instance of someone coming from outer space and landing here on our planet, except one time. 2,000 years ago, there was one who came from heaven, outer space, I suppose, and appeared here on earth. He was truly from out of this world. In John, the first chapter, in verse 1, we read that he was in the beginning with God, and he was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that hath been made. He didn't begin here on earth. He didn't begin at all. He was always in existence. But verse 14 of that first chapter of John says that the Word, who was in the beginning with God, who was God, by whom all things were made, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld His glory, glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Matthew and Luke tell about His birth of a woman. But this was, as we've said already, and I want to stress it, not His beginning. He already existed. But He came in the appearance as a man. He didn't look different from other human beings. But He was supernatural. And rather than coming in hostility, He came in peace. He came with love for every human being on earth. And no one has ever existed on this earth who was so marvelous a servant, whose benefit was so great as was His while He lived here. He assured those of His day that He had come down from heaven. In John, the 6th chapter and verse 38, He made such a statement. He said, "I have come down from heaven, not to do my own will, but the will of Him who sent me." And in the 8th chapter and verse 23, He said to them, "You are from beneath. I am from above. You are of this world. I am not of this world." And then when we turn to John, the 17th chapter, after much of his life had been lived, some 33 years, he prayed to God. And in verse 11, he said, "Now I am no longer in the world." He'd been telling his apostles, his disciples, he was going to leave. But he said, these apostles are in the world, and I come to you. Holy Father, keep through your name those whom you have given me, that they may be one as we are." Now, he died the next day. But on the third day, he arose from the grave. And for about 40 days, he showed himself alive by many infallible proofs. Until, as we read in the first chapter of the book of Acts, he was speaking to his disciples just outside of Jerusalem, beginning with verse 9, after he had spoken these things while they watched, he was taken up, and a cloud received him out of their sight. And while they looked steadfastly toward heaven as he went up, behold, two men stood by them in white apparel, who also said, "Men of Galilee, why do you stand gazing into heaven? This same Jesus, who was taken up from you into heaven, will so come in like manner as you saw him go into heaven." So here is this being from heaven who comes to earth in the form of an infant, grows to manhood, much as any other human being would, favor with God and man, lives his life on earth, but assures everyone that he is not of this world, and then eventually is seen to go back into heaven. Now, what is this world that Jesus was not of? Well, he certainly lived here. In fact, he said that. And he walked on the face of the earth. He ate the food that grew from the ground. And he also was thirsty and drank the water that was drawn from a well. He was hungry from time to time and weary, just as any human being is. And so he was, in one sense, a part of this world in which he lived. Physically he was. And he ate and drank, as we've said, as any other human being would eat and drink. He wore clothing very much like the clothing of those with whom he was associated. I don't think he spoke in some kind of strange accent. And as we've said, there was nothing in him that would set him apart in appearance from other people. So if you had seen him, you wouldn't realize that there was anything different about him until you got really, really well acquainted with him. Then I would think that you would have considered him a rather unusual person. This world of which he was not a part is a world that has a ruler. It's a world that has its own goals. It's a world that has its own values, its own destiny, and its own rewards. Now, what are the characteristics of this world of which Jesus was not a part? Well, Satan is the ruler of it. In 2 Corinthians, the 4th chapter and verse 4, he is said to be the god of this world. He's not the god of the next world or the other world. He's the god of this world. That's the world of which Jesus was not a part. The goals of this world are said in 1 John 2 and 16 to be the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life. That's what worldly people are pursuing. Now, not everyone is pursuing all of these. There are those who are pursuing particularly the lust of the flesh. What they want more than any other thing is pleasure. If they are hot, they want to be cool. If they're cold, they want to be warm. If they're hungry, they want to be fed. They want this body to be absolutely comfortable, and they want it to enjoy every pleasure of which this body is capable. And they will wring out of it all of the enjoyment and all of the pleasure that they can possibly obtain. There are other people, however, who are not nearly so concerned about pleasure as they are things. And in fact, they will punish their body, sometimes even being cold, because they are not willing to turn up the heat. They have the money to do it, but they want to have more money, and it was going to cost them, so they won't turn up the heat when it's cold, and they won't turn on the air conditioner. They may not even have one when it's hot, because that would cost them money. And what they want is all the money they can get, or all the things that money can buy, that they can possess. Having things is what it's all about. And they never get enough. It doesn't matter how much money they have, they want more money. And they will actually run risks, even though they have more money than they could possibly spend in a lifetime. They will run risks and eventually many times be brought into court and put even in prison because they are not satisfied with what they have. They want more, more, more. That's what their life is all about. And there are other people who are not so concerned for that. But they want to be famous. They want to be someone important, someone prominent. Maybe because of the power they have, maybe because of the fame they've attained on the sports field or in the theater or on the stage, whatever. They will hurt their bodies, sacrifice their bodies. They will sacrifice money in order to attain it. This is what this. It may be political office that they're seeking, but they want to be somebody important. They want everybody to know them and know who they are and respect and honor them. And when you think about it, I marvel sometimes at how wonderfully the Word of God analyzes. There's not any other goal much that you can describe as far as this world is concerned. And most everybody you see is pursuing one of these things. One of them is dominating his life. What are the values of this world? Fame, fortune, and power. These things that people are pursuing, the one who attains them is, well, he's the one that is really valuable. It may be the person who is famous because he's a great musician or a great sports figure. Or it may be a person who is famous because of his political office. Or it may be a person who's rich. And the rich person is considered far more valuable than the homeless poor person. And the person who has power is more valuable than the person who's just a nobody. You know how the world views greatness. You know whom the world honors. Well, what is the destiny? 1 John 2:16 is the passage from which we noted that all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life. Verse 17 says, though, in connection with these very things, that the world is passing away and the lust of it. The world is passing away. It's destined to pass away. And the person who has pursued pleasure comes to the point where he can no more enjoy pleasure. Solomon even speaks of that in Ecclesiastes 12, doesn't he? When the evil days come and the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. The person who has pursued money, in many instances, is going to lose it while he even lives. It's amazing how many wealthy people die in debt. Not only that, but many a person who has power loses that power, becomes a nobody for one reason or another. He's not going to keep, but all of these things are lost when life ends. And all of the things that have been accumulated, even if they be left to one's sons or one's daughters to descendants as and wills, it's all going to fade. 2 Peter, the 3rd chapter, beginning with verse 10, says, the day of the Lord will come. That's a day of judgment. That's when you get to the bottom line. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are therein it shall be burned up. That farm you may treasure, that diamond you may really love, marquee that may have your name on it, or that medal that you won in the Olympics, whatever it is, it's going to be gone one of these days. You may lose it now. If not, you'll leave it when you die. This world has nothing permanent to offer. That means that whatever rewards you receive from it are here and now. There's nothing hereafter. When you die, that's all there is. Now, Jesus was not of this world. Jesus was of another world. Jesus did not obey Satan. Satan undertook to cause him to do so. In fact, he showed him all the kingdom of the world and said, I'll give these to you if you'll just bow down and worship me. And he wasn't asking just for some physical act. He meant if you'll give your devotion to me, if you will pledge your allegiance, your loyalty to me, I'll give you these things. And how many a person has sold his soul for a kingdom or for fame or for power, whatever it might be. But Jesus said, it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. And in the 5th chapter of the book of John and verse 30, Jesus made a statement concerning the will that he had come into the world to do. In John 5 and verse 30, Jesus said, I do not seek my own will, but the will of the Father who sent me. Jesus said concerning Satan that he was coming, but he said that he has nothing in me. There was nothing in Jesus that would yield to Satan. Satan was the enemy, and Satan was not to be honored, respected, or obeyed. Jesus had desires of the flesh, just as all of us have desires of the flesh. He was hungry. I have no doubt that Jesus had sexual desires. He desired to be cool. He desired to be warm. Jesus had desires for things. Jesus had the possibility of at least being self-respecting. But Jesus controlled these things. Every desire you have can be controlled because God has given you the power to do it. And Jesus did it. Sometimes there's an argument about whether Jesus could have sinned, whether he could, and whether he's really an example for us. Let me tell you, Jesus had both a divine nature and a human nature. He was both divine and human. 100% divine, 100% human. Figure that one out. But that's the picture we have of him in the Scriptures. But what Jesus did was always to let the divine overcome the physical. I think when he was in the garden and prayed, Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. This was the physical desire, calling out for relief and for escape from the suffering that he knew was ahead of him. But the divine came to play when he said, not my will, but yours be done. Whatever we desire can be used for good. God, all the desires God has given us as He gave them to us. Now, sometime we can whet them and feed them until they become our masters. But Jesus, all the desires that we have in our bodies are something God has given us for our good. The desire for food is necessary. When a person ceases to want to eat, he's sick. He's headed for weakness. The desire for water is important, and it must be satisfied for the good of the body. The desire for comfort is important. The desire for sleep is something that we must actually satisfy, or we'll wear the body out. The desire for sexual relations is given to us by God for the procreation of the race. That's one of the reasons there's no point in homosexuality. That's one of the reasons it has no use. It's a violation of God's plan and of nature. But all of these are, God, at the same time He gave us desires, gave us the ability to control those desires. And when Satan comes and inflames those desires, we too, as Christians, can be partakers of a divine nature that can control those fleshly desires and control that appetite for things and control that desire to be somebody important and big. If we just do what Jesus did, let the divine, the Spirit, control and not the flesh. In fact, that's what is all involved in being a Christian. That's those works of the flesh and fruit of the Spirit that are described in the 5th chapter of the book of Galatians begin by saying that we are to live by the Spirit and will not fulfill the desires of the flesh. Let the Spirit win. And once you decide that's the way it's going to be and feed your spirit with the Word of God, then you can resist temptation. You can overcome it. And that's exactly what Jesus did. Jesus' loyalty was to God, not to Satan. Jesus controlled his flesh. He had no wealth, but he didn't care for wealth. He said the birds have their nest and the foxes have their holes. The Son of Man doesn't have a place to lay his head. But do you think he lost a night's sleep over it? That's not what he was here for. And as long as he had a place to sleep, it didn't matter whether it was his or somebody else's, he could sleep and rest. The coat in which he had on when he was arrested was something someone had given to him. But that was all right. No human honor, no human pride did Jesus ever have. In fact, he said concerning honor that the Pharisees sought the honor of men. John the 5th chapter and verse 41, he said, "I do not receive honor from men." That's almost an understatement, isn't it? The fact is, he was despised and rejected by men. But do you think that altered his course one iota? Not at all. Even his disciples fled at the time of the crucifixion. But that made no difference. He hadn't come to be honored by men. And this desire to be honored by men can influence and affect us so much. He said to the Pharisees in verse 44, "How can you believe who receive honor from one another and do not seek the honor that comes from the only God?" That world that Jesus was not of was a world that seeks the honor of men. The world from which Jesus came desired only the honor of God, that God approved. Now, if good people approved, all right. But the primary thing was God's evaluation of an individual. Even the enemies of Jesus said, "We know you don't respect the person of people." Jesus was not one who was just going to fall all over himself admiring some sports hero. Jesus was not one who was going to start dressing so he'd look like the latest fashion model on the stage because of the way she could sing or he could sing or something. It is absolutely amazing to me that whatever one of these, shall I say, musicians, that's what they claim they're doing, making music, and all of you know it's not my kind of music, but I'm not concerned about the aesthetics of the thing. It's a lascivious music, and the dancing that goes with it is lascivious, and the dress is intended to stir the appetites of the flesh, to cause one to lust after the person on the stage. And the more lustfully that person can perform, the more popular they become, and the more people you see out on the streets trying to look just like them. It's rather ridiculous sometimes to see some big fat person trying to look like one of these slender entertainers dressed like them, and it's... Well, anyway, we will get off that. But can you imagine Jesus being in some entertainer's fan club? Can you imagine Jesus being all taken with some political figure? Can you imagine Jesus being a Herodian, in other words? There was a political party called the Herodians. Can you imagine Jesus being active in pushing a Herod or a Pilate or anybody else, no matter how good he might, that to be identified that way? Jesus was just not of this world. And these things that made people think that they were great, Jesus was not concerned with. And in contrast with those who perish, Jesus ever lives. And he, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross. How could he endure the cross? He knew that beyond the cross, there was a crown. That's the way. If he had only been seeking what he could have in this life, the cross would have been foolish. But when he saw beyond the cross the crown, then for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame. That is, just not even considering the shame of the cross, because he saw the honor that God gives in the world to come. Now, Jesus didn't come to earth as just some kind of an experiment, just for some kind of a travel adventure. Go down there and live among those people 33 years, and then I'll think I'll go back, and that'll be the end of it. That wasn't it at all. Jesus came here on earth to try to gather people to be a part of his kingdom, and to go with him into his kingdom. To call people out of this world into a heavenly kingdom. And some things he said involved that. He said in John 18:36, after speaking again and again and again about who could enter the kingdom of heaven, describing the kind of people who would enter and the conditions of entering, he said in John 18:36, my kingdom is not of this world. Now, he's told us how to get into the kingdom, but he said it's not of this world. And his apostles, when they followed him, were not of this world. In the 17th chapter of John, in that prayer in which he prayed to the Father, saying that he was not of the world, he said concerning his apostles in verse 16, they're not of the world, just as I'm not of the world. How is that? They had left this world and followed Jesus, and allowed him to become their leader, the one whom they would follow. Early Christians had citizenship in heaven. Colossians 1:13 says, he has translated us out of the power of darkness into the kingdom of his dear Son. And this morning, we were led in a study of the third chapter of the book of Philippians, which ends with these words, our citizenship is in heaven. Oh, that our citizenship in heaven could mean as much to us as our citizenship in the United States. I'm thankful to be a citizen of the United States. Don't misunderstand me. But I'm afraid it doesn't mean as much to most of us as our citizenship in this country. I think we get more concerned about the future of this country than we do the kingdom of heaven. Our hearts are centered in Washington rather than heaven. And we're more concerned about what sin is going to do to this country than we are to the people who are going to be lost. Our citizenship is in heaven, from which we also eagerly wait for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform our lowly body that it may be conformed to his glorious body, according to the working by which he is able even to subdue all things unto himself. And being citizens of heaven, they proved it. They proved it. And what can we say about them? Well, one thing is, that instead of the God of this world, they were subject to Jesus Christ. Jesus said in Matthew 28, 19 and 20, "Go therefore and make disciples." Go therefore. What's that therefore? Well, he had just said, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go therefore and make disciples, make followers of me who will recognize my authority." And so these who followed Jesus had left Satan's authority and had accepted the authority of Jesus. Satan was the ruler of this world still, 2 Corinthians 4, verse 4. But Jesus is the ruler of the kingdom of heaven, of that other world, and they've accepted him as their ruler. Not only that, but their goals now are Christ-likeness. Christ-likeness. Not to be to satisfy the flesh, not to gratify the lust of the eye, not to be proud and to be important in the world's sight, but rather, and that thing sure has gotten mixed up, hasn't it? Rather to be like Christ. In Romans the 8th chapter and verse 29, the very purpose for which we were created was that we may be made into the image of God's Son. That's what Romans 8:29 tells us. That we were created to be like God's Son. God had a Son He loved, and He said, I want many sons like that. And so He created us, and when we had failed to recognize what He wanted, He sent Him down there and said, "There He is. Now that's what you're supposed to be like. There He is. There He is." Ephesians the 4th chapter, verses 12 and 13 tells us that's the purpose of the local church, that we all might come to the measure of the image of the stature of Christ. That's what this church is all about. It's not growing to be as large as it can be. It's not to have as big and fine a building as we can possess. It is not here for the purpose of entertaining people or educating people. It's to make everybody like Jesus. Every member of this congregation as much like Jesus as possible. That's what this church is all about. And this church is a success if the members of this church are being more like Jesus every day. But it's failing if they're not. I don't care what the contribution is. I don't care what kind of building they have. I don't care what the attendance is. I don't care what important people might become members of the congregation. If individuals are not becoming more like Jesus every day, this church is a failure. That's what it's all about. 1 Peter says that we even hereunto we are called, because Christ suffered, giving us an example that we should follow in His steps, who did no sin, neither was guile found in His mouth. When He was reviled, revile not again. When He suffered, He threatened not. And you know, that just covers, when we think about that, I think we think about not committing adultery. Maybe not cursing. But what He says, when He was reviled, He reviled not again. When He suffered, He threatened not. When a person is tested, when he's made angry, when somebody mistreats him, when someone persecutes him, there that person is being tested to see whether he's like Jesus, just as surely as if he's confronting some temptation to adultery or to drink or to cursing. How do you react when people mistreat you? I know how people in this world act. But how do you act when you're following Jesus? This is a serious matter, my friends. Now, the world, many religious groups seem to put very little emphasis on that. But that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about, making each one of us into the likeness of Jesus Christ. And what are the values of this other world? In the 10th chapter of the book of Mark, when some of the disciples of Jesus were wanting a high position in the kingdom, Jesus said, "I can't appoint you to that. You attain that by your conduct." In Mark, the 10th chapter, verses 35 beginning and reading through verse 45, Jesus had this to say to His disciples who were seeking this when James and John came wanting to sit one on His right hand on the other. Verse 38, Jesus said, "You do not know what you ask. Can you drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with?" And they said, "Oh, we can." You know, the cup bearer was the most trusted servant the king had. The way kings were killed those days were not with a pistol. They were killed with poison. And so they were very, very concerned about being poisoned. And so they would have a very trusted servant to be their cupbearer. And he would take a taste out of the cup first to prove it wasn't poison. And then he'd give it to the king. Jesus said, "Are you can you drink out of my cup?"
"Oh, yes, we can."
Jesus said, "You will indeed drink the cup that I drink, and with the baptism I'm baptized with, you will be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared. And for whom it is prepared, is it prepared? It's prepared for those who are like the king." And what can be said of the king? He was a servant. He was the ultimate servant of all time. And those who would be his first prime ministers would be those who are the most serviceable, those who are most sacrificial in their concern for others and their service to others. That's who would be first. In verse 42, he says, "You know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentile lord it over them, and the great exercise authority over them." A man with 10 people under him is great. But sometimes I've had fathers boast to me, just, "My son has 50 people under him, or 400 people under him, or 1,000 people in his company that are under his authority." Jesus said, "That doesn't make any difference. That doesn't matter." He says, "It shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant." In this other kingdom, greatness is determined by service. And that one who serves, 1 John 2:17, that one who is a part of this other world abides forever. And the 1 Thessalonian letter, chapter 4, picks up the story. You remember when we read that Jesus ascended to the Father, and there were men in white apparel that were standing there saying to the disciples, "Why stand gazing into heaven? He who's gone up will come again." 1 Thessalonians 4 tells about that coming again. Let's read just a little, beginning with verse 13. "I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep, that your sorrow is those who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus," those who died, the godly ones, those who pertain to this other world, those who are citizens of the kingdom of heaven, the Lord will bring them with him. "For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who are asleep, those who have died. Those who are alive will have no advantage over those who died. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive and remain will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord. And whereas the person who's lived his life for pleasure, whether the one who's lived his life for things, the person who's lived his life to be important in the eyes of the world, has lost everything, that's when the servant of the Lord gains everything. The sands have been washed in the footprints of the stranger on Galilee's shore, and the voice that subdued the rough billows will be heard in Judea no more. But the path of that lone Galilean will I joyfully follow today, and the toil of the road will seem nothing when I get to the end of the way. If I can just go to heaven, it doesn't make any difference how many people have laughed at me. It doesn't matter how many days and weeks and months and years I may have spent in an old rundown house, how much I may have suffered of cold or heat or hunger or a cold. It doesn't matter at all whether anybody knew me or didn't know me. It doesn't matter whether I had a dime or $1 million. It doesn't make a bit of difference if the Lord, when he comes, takes me home to be with him. That's the only thing that matters. I see two roads. One of them is an easy road. The other is a difficult road. And Jesus says, "Enter by the narrow gate. For wide is the gate and broad is the way, and many there go in by it." I like wide roads. I wish some of these around Atlanta were a little wider, especially up around Peachtree Parkway and some of these other places I've been navigating since I've been here. I like wide roads. I like roads that are easy. You can kind of coast on without having to use up all this expensive gasoline. I like roads where I'm pretty sure there are other people, not too many, but enough going to make me sure that this is okay. I've been a little bit frightened sometime on dark roads where nobody was there. And there are a lot of people going this way. There are a lot of people riding that worldly road, this world road. But my friends, the big problem is it leads where you don't want to go. On the other hand, Jesus said, narrow is the gate and difficult is the way, and few there be that find it. And why would anybody want to go a narrow, difficult road, going through a gate where you can't take a lot that other people have? A Christian just can't do everything the world can do. A Christian just can't possess everything the world possesses. They're just friends that you can't take through that narrow gate. There are sacrifices that have to be made, and that difficult way is sometimes hard to travel, but it leads to life. How do you decide which road you're going to travel when you start out somewhere? You decide it by the place you want to go, don't you? And where you want to go is heaven. But if you want to go to heaven when you die, you're going to have to be a citizen of heaven now. Now, that's home. Sometimes people talk about going home, but home is heaven for those who are citizens of heaven, citizens of the kingdom of heaven. Oh, my friends, Jesus is standing there, as it were, at the fork of the road. And you have to make your choice between this world that has so many attractions, this world that offers you so many pleasures, this world that means so much to people around you, and the world that people around you think is where it's at, so to speak. That's what the world offers. But destruction to the end. On the other hand, Jesus is calling you to a tough road, a narrow gate. Very few people going that way. They're called fanatics. They're thought of as being strange, odd, unworldly sometimes. Would you be hurt? Would you be insulted if somebody told you, you're kind of an unworldly person? Or do you prefer to be worldly wise? Those are expressions we use, aren't they? Well, you just have to be unworldly. You'll have to be strange. In the sense of being different from the world. And the worse the world becomes, the more different we're going to have to be. But it's worth it. It's worth it to go to heaven. Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. I wouldn't change that for anything in the world. There are those who say, you believe and be saved, and then you can be baptized if you want to. I can't do that. I don't think you'd want me to. Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. Jesus said, except a man be born of water and the Spirit, cannot enter the kingdom of God. It's a simple matter, but it's not an insignificant matter when a person decides to bury an old life and be raised to a new life. To leave an old world, go to a new world, another world, a better world. Citizens of a foreign country, sojourners in this land, but headed home. Isn't there someone tonight who will respond to the Lord? So thankful to hear one who did obey the Lord this afternoon. Surely there are others. Brother Bowman's appeal was so moving last night to me. Jesus is coming. You're going to stand before him in judgment. Won't you please think seriously, soberly, of taking that narrow road, making whatever sacrifice you have to make. It's not all bad in this life. Jesus said that. There are good things about this life that you'll enjoy. But heaven is the end of that narrow, difficult way. Take it. Jesus is standing there saying, take it, enter by the narrow gate. You say, well, I'll not make a decision. If you don't do something tonight, you make a decision not to do something. You make a decision to say no to Jesus, as little as you think about it. You can't afford to do that. He came to die for you. Don't say no to him when he says enter that narrow gate. trust Him, believe Him. That's what, and if you really trust Him and believe in Him, that's what you'll do tonight as we stand and sing.